Book V, the world, its birth and its death, who has the strength, with a mind powerful enough, to build a song worthy of the majesty of things and of these discoveries? Or who has such power in words that he could fashion praise to match the merits of the one who left to us such rewards, won and sought out by his own mind? No one born of mortal flesh will be equal to it, I think. For if, as the known majesty of the universe itself demands, it must be said, that man was a god, illustrious Memmius, who first discovered that reasoned way of life which is now called wisdom, and who by his skill set life, tossed on such waves and in such darkness, into so calm and so clear a light. Compare the ancient divine discoveries of others. For Ceres is said to have brought forth grain for mortals, and Liber the liquid drink born of the vine. Yet life could go on without these things, as report has it that some peoples even now live without them. But one could not live well without a mind made pure. So this man more rightly seems to us to be a god, from whom, spread now through great nations, sweet comforts of life soothe our minds. But if you think the deeds of Hercules outrank his, you will be carried far indeed from true reasoning. For what harm now to us would the great gaping jaws of that Nemean lion do, or the bristling Arcadian boar, or how greatly would the birds that haunt Stymphalus hinder us? Finally, what could the bull of Crete do, or the Lernaean scourge, the Hydra, ringed about with venomous snakes? Or what the three-bodied strength of triple Geryon, or the horses of Diomes breathing fire from their nostrils among the Thracian and Bistonian lands and by Ismarus, or the serpent guarding the golden gleaming apples of the Hesperides, fierce, glaring savagely, its monstrous body coiled about the tree's trunk? What harm, finally, would it do near the Atlantic shore and the grim stretches of that sea, where none of our people goes and no barbarian dares? And the other monsters of this sort that have been destroyed, if they had not been conquered, what harm would they do us alive, after all? None, I think. Even now the earth teems to its fill with wild beasts and is filled with trembling terror through groves and great mountains and deep forests, places which for the most part it lies in our power to avoid. But unless the mind is purged, what battles for us and dangers must then work their way in, whether we wish it or not? How greatly then do the sharp cares of desire tear at the anxious man, and how great, equally, the fears? Or pride, filth, and insolence, what great disasters they bring about, and luxury and sloth. So the man who has subdued all these, and from the mind driven them out with words, not with arms, will it not be fitting to judge this man worthy to be counted among the gods? Especially since he was accustomed to speak, well and in godlike fashion, many things to mortals now, as if giving utterance from the gods themselves, and to lay open the whole nature of things in his words. Following in his footsteps, while I pursue his reasonings and teach in my own words by what compact each thing was created, and how necessary it is to abide within it, unable to break time's strong laws, among which foremost the nature of the mind has been found to consist, being created of a body born with it, and unable to endure sound through a long age, but that phantoms are wont in dreams to deceive the mind, when we seem to see one whom life has abandoned, what remains? Now the order of my argument has brought me to this point, that I must give the reasoned account that the world too consists of a mortal body and is likewise born, and by what means that gathering together of matter founded earth, sky, sea, stars, sun, and the moon's globe. Then what living things arose upon the earth, and which were never born at any time? And in what way, as speech grew varied, the human race began to speak among themselves using names for things? And by what means that fear of the gods worked its way into hearts? Fear which through the round world watches over the sacred shrines, pools, groves, altars, and images of the gods. Besides, the course of the sun and the moon's movements I will explain, by what force guiding nature bends them, lest perhaps we think that these things, between heaven and earth, freely, of their own accord, traverse their everlasting courses, obligingly, to make crops and living things grow. Or think that they are wheeled about by some design of the gods. For even those who have rightly learned that the gods lead a carefree life, if all the same they wonder, meanwhile, by what plan each thing can be carried on, especially in those matters that are seen above our heads in the regions of the sky, are carried back again into their old superstitions and take on harsh masters, believing they can do anything, masters whom, poor wretches, they believe capable, not knowing what can be, what cannot, and what limited power, finally, belongs to each thing, by what principle, and how deeply fixed its boundary lies. As for the rest, lest I delay you further with promises, first look upon the seas, the lands, and the sky, whose threefold nature, three bodies, Memmius, three forms so unlike, three such fabrics, one single day will consign to destruction. And though sustained through many years, the mass and machinery of the world will fall in ruin. Nor does it escape me how new and strange a thing to the mind it must seem, that the destruction of sky and earth lies ahead, and how hard it is for me to win conviction of this by words. As happens when you bring some unfamiliar thing before the ears, and yet cannot set it before the sight of the eyes or place it in the hands, the road by which belief travels most directly into the human breast and the mind's chambers. But still, I will speak it out. The fact itself will lend credence to my words, perhaps, and once violent earthquakes have arisen, you will see everything shaken to pieces in a short time. May guiding fortune steer that far away from us, and may reasoning rather than the fact itself persuade us that all things, overcome, can collapse in a dread-sounding crash. But before I set about this, before I pour forth pronouncements on the matter, more sacred and far more certain in their reasoning than those the Pythias speaks from Apollo's tripod and laurel, I will lay out for you many comforts in well-taught words, lest, reined in by religious scruple, you should perhaps think that earth and sun and sky, sea, stars, and moon must remain eternal because their bodies are divine, and therefore should think it right, in the fashion of the giants, that all such men pay the penalty for a monstrous crime. Men who by their own reasoning would overthrow the ramparts of the world and wish to quench the glorious sun of heaven, branding immortal things with mortal speech. Things so utterly removed from any divine power, and so unworthy to be reckoned among the gods, that they should rather be thought fit to give us a notion of what is altogether without living motion and feeling. For indeed it cannot be thought that mind and judgment could exist together with just any body whatsoever. Just as in the sky no tree can exist, nor in the salt sea can clouds be, nor can fish live in fields, nor blood exist in wood, nor sap in stones, it is fixed and settled where each thing grows and has its place. So the nature of the mind cannot arise alone, without a body, nor exist apart, far off from sinews and blood. For if it could, the force of the mind itself might just as well exist in the head, or the shoulders, or the very heels, and would be apt to arise in any part at all, so long as it remained in the same man, in the same vessel. But since it is fixed and evidently settled, even in our own body, where the soul and mind separately can exist and grow, all the more must it be denied that the whole of it could endure outside the body and its living form, in the crumbling clods of earth, or in the fire of the sun, or in water, or in the high shores of the sky. They are not, therefore, endowed with divine feeling, since they cannot be alive with a living soul. Likewise, this too is something you cannot believe, that there are sacred dwellings of the gods in any part of the world. For the nature of the gods is subtle and far removed from our senses, scarcely seen even by the mind's understanding. And since it escapes the touch and the blow of hands, it should touch nothing that is itself tangible to us. For what cannot itself be touched cannot touch anything else. Therefore their dwellings too must be unlike our dwellings, made subtle of their own substance, which I will prove to you later, in ample discourse. To say, moreover, that the gods wish to prepare the glorious nature of the world for the sake of men, and that therefore it is fitting to praise their praiseworthy work, and think it will be everlasting and immortal, and that it is not right. This thing which by the gods' age-old design was founded for the human race to last for all time, ever to be shaken loose from its foundations by any force, or troubled by words and overturned from top to bottom, and to invent and pile on other things of this kind. Memmius, that is folly. For what advantage could our gratitude bestow upon the immortal and blessed gods that they should set about doing anything for our sake? Or what new thing, after so long a time, could entice those who before were at rest to want to change their former life? For it seems that only he ought to rejoice in new things whom the old ones vex, but the one to whom nothing troublesome happened in the time gone by, when he was living his life pleasantly. What could kindle in such a one a love of change? Or what evil would it have been for us, not to have been created? Or, I suppose, life lay in darkness and grief until the birth-giving origin of things dawned. For whoever has been born must wish to remain in life, so long as beguiling pleasure holds him fast. But he who has never truly tasted the love of life and was never among the living, what harm is it to him not to have been created? Further, the model for making things, and even the very knowledge of men, where was it first implanted in the gods, so that they might know and picture in mind what they wanted to make? Or how was the power of the first beginnings ever made known? And what they could do among themselves with their order changed around, if nature herself had not given the pattern of creation? For the first beginnings of things, in so many ways, driven by blows from infinite time now past, and by their own weight, have grown accustomed, once set moving, to be borne along and to meet in every fashion and try out every combination. Whatever they, coming together, could create among themselves. So that it is no wonder if they have also fallen into such arrangements and come into such motions as those by which this sum of things is now carried on, forever renewing itself. But even if I did not know what the first beginnings of things are, this, nonetheless, I would dare to affirm from the very workings of the sky itself, and to establish from many other facts as well, that the nature of things was in no way made ready for us by divine power, so great a flaw does it stand possessed of. To begin with, as much as the vast dome of the sky covers of that, a greedy portion mountains and forests, haunts of wild beasts have taken for themselves. Crags and vast marshes possess it, and the sea, which holds the shores of the lands far apart. Then, further, of what remains, nearly two more parts, blazing heat and the ceaseless fall of frost, take away from mortal use. What tillable land remains, nature by her own force would still choke over with brambles, did not human strength resist her, accustomed, for life's sake, to groan over the sturdy hoe and cleave the soil with the pressed-down plow. If we did not turn the fertile clods with the plowshare and subdue the soil of the earth, rousing it to bring forth, things could not of their own accord rise up into the clear air. And yet sometimes, though sought with great labor, when already they leaf out over the fields and all things flower, either the sun in the sky scorches them with excessive heat, or sudden rains destroy them, and icy frosts and blasts of wind batter them with violent gusts. Besides, why does nature feed and foster that dread race of wild beasts, hostile to humankind on land and sea? Why do the seasons of the year bring diseases? Why does untimely death roam abroad? Then further, the child, like a sailor cast up by savage waves, lies naked on the ground, an infant lacking all help for life. When first, into the shores of light, nature has poured him out from his mother's womb by her labor, and he fills the place with mournful crying, as is fitting for one who has so much evil left to pass through in life. But the various flocks, herds, and wild beasts grow up with no need of little rattles, nor must anyone offer them the fond, broken, lisping speech of a kindly nurse, nor do they seek varied clothes to suit the season of the weather. Finally, they need no weapons, no high walls to guard what is theirs, since to all of them, all things abundantly the earth herself brings forth, and nature, that skilled artisan of things. To begin with, since the body of the earth and moisture and the light breath of the winds and warm vapors, out of which this sum of things is seen to be composed, all consist of a body born and mortal, the whole nature of the world must be reckoned of the same kind. For indeed, those things whose parts and members we see to be, in a body that is born, of mortal shape, these same wholes we find are likewise mortal and born as well. And so, since I see the greatest members and parts of the world, once consumed, born again, we may know that for the sky too, and likewise for the earth, there was some beginning in time, and a destruction is to come. Do not think, in this matter, that I have seized on this rashly for my own purpose, taking earth and fire to be mortal, and not doubting that moisture and air perish too, and saying that these same things are born and grow again. To begin with, a certain part of the earth, scorched by unceasing suns and much beaten by the tread of feet, breathes out a mist of dust, and clouds of it flying up, which strong winds scatter through the whole air. A part of the clods, too, is called back into a flood by rains, and rivers grazing their banks gnaw them away. Besides, for its part, whatever earth nourishes and makes grow is given back to it. And since it seems, beyond doubt, that she is at once the all-bearing mother of things and their common tomb, therefore the earth, you see, is drained away, and replenished, grows again. As for what remains, that with fresh moisture the sea, rivers, and springs are ever abounding, and that waters flow on unceasingly, there is no need of words. The great rush of waters declares it from every side. But whatever water is first taken away, so that in the total sum no moisture ever runs to excess. Partly this is because strong winds, sweeping the sea's surface, diminish it, and the sun in the sky unravels it with his rays, partly because it is spread out underground, through all the lands. For the brine is filtered out, and back it seeps, the substance of the moisture, and gathers at the source for all the rivers. From there it flows over the lands in a sweet stream, along the channel once cut, by which its waters have carried their liquid tread. Now then, I will speak of the air, which in its whole body is changed innumerable times, hour by separate hour. For always, whatever flows away from things, all of it is carried into the great sea of air. And unless that air, in return, gave back bodies to things and renewed what flows away from them, everything by now would have been dissolved and turned into air. It does not cease, therefore, being born out of things and falling back into things, since it is settled that all things flow ceaselessly. Likewise, the abundant fountain of liquid light, the sun in the sky, continually floods the heaven with fresh brightness and instantly replenishes light with new light. For whatever first of its brightness perishes, wherever it happens to fall, this you can recognize from the following. As soon as clouds begin to pass beneath the sun, and, as it were, to break its rays of light apart, at once the whole lower portion of them perishes and the earth is shadowed, wherever the clouds are carried. So that you may know that things always stand in need of fresh brightness, and that each first outpouring of brightness perishes, and things cannot be seen in the sunlight by any other means unless the very fountainhead of light perpetually replenishes it. Why, even those nightly, earthly lights for you, hanging lamps, and torches bright with flashing flames, thick with much soot, hasten on by a like process, heat as their servant to supply new light. They press on, trembling with fires, press on, nor does the light leave gaps in between as though broken. So hastily, from all their fires, is their destruction hastened on by the swift renewal of flame. So then, it must be thought that sun, moon, and stars cast their light from one fresh rising after another, and always lose whatever flame comes first. Lest you should chance to believe these things endure inviolable. Finally, do you not see that even stones are conquered by time, that tall towers collapse and rocks crumble away, that the shrines of the gods and their images grow weary and fall apart, and their sacred godhead cannot push back the bounds of fate, nor strive against the covenants of nature? Finally, do we not see the monuments of men crumbling away? To inquire further, you might believe that each thing grows old in its own way. Do not boulders torn loose fall from high mountains, unable to bear and endure the strong forces of time for any finite span? For they would not suddenly fall, torn loose, if they had endured, from infinite time past, every battering of age without ever being shattered. Finally, now consider this. That which all around and above holds the earth in its embrace, if it brings forth from itself all things, as some relate, and takes back what has perished, then the whole of it consists, being born, of a mortal body. For whatever thing feeds and nourishes other things out of itself must be diminished, then renewed, when it takes those things back. Besides, if there was no birth origin for lands and sky, and they had always been eternal, why, before the Theban War and the fall of Troy, did other poets not also sing of other deeds? Why have so many deeds of men fallen away so often, and nowhere do they still flourish, set fast in the eternal monuments of fame? But, as I think, the sum of things is a new thing, and recent is the nature of the world, nor did it take its beginnings long ago. That is why certain arts even now are still being refined, still growing. Now much has been added to ships, and only recently musicians have brought forth melodic sounds. Finally, this very nature of things and its system was discovered only lately, and I myself, found among the very first to do so, am now the one able to turn it into the speech of my own land. But if perhaps you believe that all these same things existed before now, but that generations of men perished in a scorching blaze, or that cities fell in some vast convulsion of the world, or that, from ceaseless rains, ravening rivers overran the lands and swallowed up towns, all the more must you, defeated, confess that the destruction of earth and sky as well is still to come. For when things were assailed by such great sicknesses and such great perils, if then a still grimmer cause had come to bear upon them, they would have brought disaster and vast ruin far and wide. Nor by any other reasoning do we appear to be mortal among ourselves, except that we fall sick with the same diseases as those whom nature has removed from life. Besides, whatever things remain eternal must do so either because, having a solid body, they repel blows and let nothing penetrate them that could their tightly packed inner parts pull apart, as is true of the bodies of matter, whose nature we have shown before, or because they can endure through the whole of time for this reason, that they are exempt from blows, as the void is, which stays untouched and is affected not at all by any stroke, or else because there is no supply of room around them into which, as it were, things could scatter and be dissolved, as the sum of all sums is eternal, nor is there, outside it, any place into which its parts could fly apart, nor are there bodies that could fall upon it and dissolve it with a mighty blow. But neither, as I have taught, is the nature of the world of a solid body, since void is mixed in among things, nor yet is it like the void. And moreover, bodies are not lacking which, chancing to have arisen out of the infinite, could crash down upon this sum of things with violent tumult, or bring on some other disaster of ruin. Nor further does the extent of space and the depth of room run short, into which the ramparts of the world could be scattered, or perish, struck down by some other force whatsoever. The door of death, therefore, is not barred to the sky, nor to sun and earth, nor to the deep waves of the sea, but stands open, gaping back with a monstrous, vast mouth. Wherefore you must also confess that these same things are born, for things that are of mortal body could not, out of infinite time already past, up to now, have been able to defy the mighty forces of measureless age. Finally, since the greatest members of the world so greatly fight among themselves, stirred up by a war anything but holy, do you not see that some end of their long struggle could be granted them? Say, when the sun and all its heat have drunk up every moisture and won the mastery. This they are striving to do, but their attempts are not yet accomplished. So much do the rivers supply, and beyond that they threaten to drown everything in flood, out of the sea's deep gulf, in vain, since the winds sweeping the sea's surface lessen it, and the sun in the sky, unraveling it with his rays. And they are confident they can dry up everything before the water could reach the goal of what it undertook. Breathing out so great a war in a contest of equal forces, they struggle to fight out a great matter between themselves, though meanwhile fire has once already gained the upper hand, and once, as the story goes, water reigned over the fields. For fire prevailed once, and, spreading round, burned up much, when the ravening force of the sun's horses dragged Phaethon over trackless wastes, through the whole sky and over all the lands. But the Almighty Father, then stirred by fierce anger, struck great-hearted Phaethon down with a sudden bolt of lightning, cast him down off his horses onto the earth. And the sun, meeting him as he fell, caught up the eternal lamp of the world and gathered the scattered horses back together and yoked them, trembling then, guiding all things, set them going again along their own path. So, at least, the old Greek poets have sung, which is thrust far too wide of true reasoning. For fire can gain the mastery when, of matter, more bodies than usual have arisen out of the infinite. Then its powers fall away, overcome by some cause, or things perish, burned up by the scorching winds. Water likewise once began to prevail, having risen in excess, as the story goes, when it overwhelmed the lives of men with its waves. Then, when its force, turned back by some cause, withdrew whatever of it had arisen out of the infinite, the rain ceased and the rivers lessened their force. But by what means that hurling together of matter founded the earth and sky and the deep places of the sea, and the courses of sun and moon, I will now set out in order. For certainly the first beginnings of things did not, by design, arrange themselves each in its own order with sagacious mind, nor indeed did they agree among themselves what motions each should produce. But because the first beginnings of things, many in many ways, driven by blows out of infinite time already past, and by their own weight, have grown accustomed, once set moving, to be carried and to meet together in every fashion, trying out every combination they might create, coming together among themselves. For this reason it happens that, scattered abroad through a vast stretch of time, by trying every kind of meeting and motion, at last those combinations come together which, suddenly thrown together, often become the beginnings of great things, of earth, sea, and sky, and of the race of living creatures. Here, at that time, neither could the sun's wheel be seen with its abundant light, flying high, nor the stars of the great world, nor sea, nor sky, nor finally earth, nor air, nor could anything be seen like the things we know, but only a strange new condition and mass that had arisen. From there, the regions began to scatter apart, and like parts began to join with like, and things began to divide the world, separating its members and arranging its great regions out of first beginnings of every kind, whose discord in distances, paths, connections, weights, blows, collisions, motions, threw everything into confusion, mingling conflicts, because of their unlike forms and varied shapes, since not all of them could remain joined together in that way, nor produce fitting motions among themselves, that is, to separate the high sky from the lands, and the sea set apart, to lie open with its own separate moisture, and likewise apart, the fires of the pure and separate ether. For indeed, first, the several bodies of earth, because they were heavy and entangled, kept converging in the middle, and all took up the lowest seats. And the more entangled among themselves they came together, the more they squeezed out those things which would make up the sea, the stars, the sun, and the moon, and the ramparts of the great world. For all these things are made rather of light and round seeds, and of far smaller elements than earth is. That is why, through the sparse openings of the earth, bursting out bit by bit, the fire-bearing ether first raised itself up, and being light, carried off many fires along with it. Not by a process much different from what we often see, when first, golden, through the dew-jeweled grass, the morning beams of the radiant sun grow red, and lakes breathe out mist, and the ever-flowing rivers, and the earth itself at times seems to be smoking. And when all these gather together, rising upward on high clouds, their body now condensed, weave a veil beneath the sky. So then, at that time, the light and diffusible ether, its body now condensed, spread itself round on every side and enclosed things, and widely diffused on every side into every quarter, thus enclosed all the rest in a greedy embrace. Upon this followed the beginnings of sun and moon, whose globes revolve in the air lying between the two regions, which neither earth claimed for itself, nor the vast ether, because they were neither so heavy that they settled down, nor so light that they could glide along the outermost edges, and yet they are so placed between the two that they turn like living bodies and stand out as parts of the whole world. Just as in ourselves certain limbs may remain at rest, even while there are others that move. With these things, then, withdrawn, the earth suddenly sank down, where now the vast blue expanse of the sea stretches out, and flooded the hollows with its salt tide. And day by day, the more, all around, the surging tides of ether and the rays of the sun pressed in upon the earth on every side, packing it tight at its outer edges with repeated blows, so that, driven in upon itself, condensed, it drew together at the center, the more squeezed out from its body, the salty sweat increased the sea flowing forth and its swimming plains, and the more escaping outward, those many bodies of vapor and air flew forth and condensed, far from the earth, the gleaming regions of the sky. The plains sank down, and the slopes of the high mountains grew higher, for the rocks could not settle downward, nor could all the regions sink equally by the same amount. So then the weight of the earth, its body now condensed, became fixed, and as it were, all the slime of the world flowed together, heavy into the lowest place, and settled to the bottom like dregs. Then the sea, then the air, then the fire-bearing ether itself, all were left pure, with their liquid bodies, one lighter than another. And the most liquid, ether, and the lightest, flows above the airy breezes, and does not mingle its liquid body with the turbulent currents of air. It lets all that below be turned by violent whirlwinds, lets it be thrown into confusion by shifting storms, while it itself carries its own fires onward, gliding with a steady motion. That the ether flows steadily, and can move with a single, uniform force, the Pontus shows us, a sea that flows with a fixed current, preserving always one unbroken course of motion. Now let us sing what the cause is of the motions of the stars. To begin with, if the great vault of the sky revolves, we must say that air presses upon the pole from either side, and holds it in from outside, and encloses it on both ends. Then that another current flows above and presses in the same direction in which the eternal stars of the wheeling world glitter as they turn, or another beneath, which, from the opposite side, drives the circle upward, just as we see rivers turn wheels and their scoop buckets. It is also possible that the whole sky might stay fixed in place, even while the bright constellations are carried along, either because the swift currents of enclosed ether, seeking a path, whirl around in a circle, and the fires roll everywhere through the topmost precincts of the sky, or because air flowing in from elsewhere, from outside, drives and turns the fires, or because they themselves can creep along, wherever each one's fuel calls and invites them onward. They're flaming bodies feeding everywhere throughout the sky. For which of these causes applies in this particular world is hard to state for certain. But what can be, and comes to be, throughout the whole, in the various worlds created by various means, that I teach, and I go on to set out several possible causes for the motions of the stars that could hold throughout the universe. Of which, nevertheless, one must be the cause in this case too, the one that stirs the constellations into motion. But which of these it is by no means for one advancing step by step to lay down for certain. And as for the earth resting in the mid-region of the world, it is fitting that its weight should gradually vanish and diminish, and that it should have a different nature beneath it, joined from the very start of time and fitted as one with the airy parts of the world, in which embedded it has its life. For this reason it is no burden, and it does not weigh down the air, just as a man's own limbs are no weight to him, nor is the head a burden to the neck, nor, finally, do we feel the whole weight of the body resting in the feet. But whatever weights come from outside and are laid upon us do hurt us, though often much smaller. So much, indeed, does it matter what capacity each thing has. So then, the earth is not something foreign, suddenly brought in and thrust upon breezes not its own, from elsewhere, but was conceived equally from the very origin of the world, and is a fixed part of it, just as our limbs seem to us a fixed part of ourselves. Besides, when the earth is suddenly shaken by great thunder, it shakes with its motion all the things that lie above it, which it could not do by any means, unless it were bound fast to the airy parts of the world and to the sky, for they cling together by roots held in common, joined from time's very beginning, and grown as one. Do you not see, too, with how great a weight the most subtle force of the soul sustains our body, because it is so closely joined and fitted to it as one? Finally, to lift the body with a swift leap, what has the power to do this, except the force of the soul that governs the limbs? Do you see now how much power a subtle nature can have when it is joined with a heavy body, as air is joined to lands, and the force of mind is joined to us? Nor can the sun's disk be much greater, nor its heat much less, than it appears to be to our senses. For from whatever distance fires can cast their light and breathe warm heat upon our limbs, they lose nothing of their flame's substance across great intervals, nor does the fire appear any smaller to the eye. Accordingly, since the sun's heat and its outpoured light reach our senses, and the places they strike are bright, its shape too, and its outline must from this be seen truly, so that you cannot truly add anything to it, more or less. Reach our senses and the places they touch are bright. And the moon, whether it moves, lighting up places with borrowed light, or casts its own light from its own body, whatever the case, it moves with a shape no greater than it appears to be, as we perceive it with our eyes. For in fact, all things that we view from far off, through a great stretch of air, appear blurred in outline before their edge shrinks. So the moon of necessity, since it presents a clear appearance and a definite shape, marked as it is at its outer edges, whatever its true size, must appear to us from here, up in the sky, just that size. Finally, whatever fires of the sky you see from here, you may be sure they can be smaller by only the merest trifle, or larger by some slight and brief amount. Since whatever fires we perceive on earth, as long as their flicker and their bright glow can still be made out, seem, at times, to change by some very small amount in their outline, one way or the other, the further off they are. Likewise, this is not to be wondered at, by what means that small sun can send out so much light as, flooding all the seas and lands and sky, to fill them and drench everything with its warm heat. However large it truly is, it should appear to us from here, up in the sky, just that large, for it may be that here a single fountain, opened up for the whole world, richly flowing, gushes and bursts out with light. Because in this way, from every part of the world, the elements of heat gather together on every side, and thus their combined mass flows together, so that from one single source this heat streams forth. Do you not see, too, how widely a small spring of water sometimes waters meadows and floods out over the fields? It is also possible that, from no great fire of the sun, a blaze seizes the air with hot flarings, if by chance the air is so ready and so suited, that, once struck, it can be kindled by small sparks of heat. just as sometimes we see crops and stubble catch fire everywhere from a single spark. Perhaps, too, the sun, shining high with its rosy lamp, possesses much fire around itself in hidden blazes, marked by no visible gleam, heat-bearing, only to intensify the force of its rays. Nor does one single, straightforward account of the sun lie open, as to how, from the summer quarters, it comes round to the winter turning point of Capricorn, and, returning from there, turns back toward the solstice marks of Cancer, and how the moon in its months seems to traverse that same span in which the sun spends its yearly course. Not, I say, is a single cause assigned for these things. For it seems this could happen, foremost among the reasons, as the revered opinion of the man Democritus sets forth. The closer each star is to the earth, the less it can be swept along with the whirling of the sky. For the swift and keen forces of that whirl vanish and grow weaker down below, and so the sun is left behind, little by little, along with the constellations that follow it, because it lies much lower than the blazing signs. And this is still more true of the moon. The lower its course lies, far from the sky, and the closer it draws to the earth, the less it can keep pace with the constellations in its course. And the more feebly it is carried by that weaker whirl, being lower than the sun, by so much the more do all the constellations overtake it and pass it by, wheeling around. That is why it happens that the moon seems to return to each sign more swiftly, because the signs come back around to it. It happens, too, that, from the crosswise regions of the world, air currents, flowing alternately, each in turn at a fixed time, might thrust the sun away from the summer signs as far as the wintry turning points and cold rigor, and might throw it back from the icy shadows of cold all the way to the heat-bearing regions and the blazing signs. And by a like reasoning, it must be thought that the moon and the stars, which trace out great years in their great orbits, can move by currents of air alternating from different quarters. Do you not see, too, that clouds, driven by opposing winds, travel in opposite directions, the lower ones against the upper? Why should those stars be any less able, through the great circuits of the sky, to be carried along by currents that differ among themselves? But night overwhelms the lands with a vast murk, either when the sun, at the end of its long course, has reached the sky's furthest edge, and, grown weak, breathes out its fires, shaken by the journey and worn down by so much air, or because that same force compels it to turn its course beneath the earth, which carried its disk above the lands. Likewise, at a fixed time, Matuta spreads the rosy dawn along the shores of the sky and unfolds its light, either because that same sun, returning beneath the earth, gets there ahead of time, trying to kindle the sky with its rays, or because fires and many seeds of heat are accustomed to gather and flow together at a fixed time, which cause the sun's light to be born ever anew. Just as from the high mountains of Ida, so the story goes, scattered fires are seen at the rising light of dawn, which then gather together, as it were, into a single mass and form a disk. Nor yet, in these matters, ought it to seem wondrous that these seeds of fire can, at so fixed a time, flow together and renew the sun's brightness. For we see many things happen at a fixed time in all matters. Trees blossom at a fixed time, and at a fixed time shed their blossom. No less does age ordain that teeth fall out at a fixed time, and that the beardless boy grow soft down on his cheeks, and likewise let a soft beard hang down from his jaws. Lastly, lightning, snow, rains, clouds, winds do not occur at times of year that are wholly unpredictable. For since the first beginnings of causes were shaped this way, and things of the world fell out thus from their very first origin, they now also return, linked together, in a fixed order. Likewise, it is possible to explain how the days grow and the nights waste away, and the daylight hours diminish, as the nights gain in length, either because that same sun, running beneath the earth and above it by unequal arcs, divides the regions of the sky, splitting its circuit into unequal parts, and what it has subtracted from one side, it restores on the opposite side, returning there by just that much more. Until it arrives at that point of the sky, where the year's turning knot equalizes the shadows of night with the hours of light. For midway between the blasts of the north wind and the south, the sky marks off its turning points with an equal division, owing to the position of the whole sign-bearing circle, in which the sun, moving slowly along, completes its yearly round, lighting up lands and sky with its slanting rays, as the reasoning of those makes clear, who have marked out all the regions of the sky, adorned with their assigned constellations. Or because the air is thicker in certain regions, and so beneath the earth the trembling gleam of fire falters and cannot easily penetrate through and emerge to its rising. For this reason, in the winter season, the long nights linger, until the radiant beacon of day arrives. Or else, because thus, in alternating parts of the year, the fires are accustomed to gather together more slowly or more swiftly, the fires that cause the sun to rise from a fixed quarter, for this reason it comes about that they seem to speak the truth. The moon can shine, struck by the sun's rays, and day by day turn that light more toward us in appearance, the further it withdraws from the sun's disk, until it has shone fully with a full light directly opposite the sun, and, as it rises, has looked down on the sun setting from on high. Then, little by little, it must, as it were, draw its light back into hiding as well, the closer it now glides toward the sun's fire, from the other side of the zodiac, along its circuit, as those hold who imagine the moon to be like a ball and to keep its course of travel beneath the sun. There is also a reason why it might, with light of its own, revolve and give back varying shapes of brightness. For it is possible there is another body, which is carried along and glides together with it, meeting it in every way and getting in its way, and it cannot be seen, because it moves without any light of its own. And it can revolve, as the globe of a ball would, if it were tinged with gleaming light on one half, and by that turning of the ball give off varying shapes, until it turns whichever part is brightened with light, to face our view and our open eyes. Then, little by little, it twists back and withdraws the light-bearing part of that sphere, that ball. As the Chaldean teaching of Babylon, in refuting the rival view, strives in turn to disprove the astrologer's art. As if that could not happen, the thing each side contends for, or as if there were less reason to dare embrace this view than that one. Finally, why should a new moon not always be created, in a fixed order of shapes and with fixed forms, and each one that has been created perish, day by separate day, and another be renewed in its part and place? It is hard to demonstrate by reasoning and prove convincingly in words, when you see so many things created in so fixed an order. Spring advances, and Venus and Venus's herald, winged, walks before her. Close on the footsteps of Zephyr comes Mother Flora, strewing the way ahead of them and fills everything with splendid colors and scents. Next in order follows parching heat and his companion dusty Ceres and the yearly blasts of the north winds. Then autumn arrives, and together with him walks Bacchus, crying Yuho. Then other storms and winds follow, the high thundering Vulturnus and the south wind, strong with its lightning. At last midwinter brings snows and restores the sluggish chill. Winter follows behind her, chattering with the teeth of frost. So it is the less to be wondered at, if at a fixed time the moon is born and at a fixed time is destroyed again, since so many things can happen at so fixed a time. Likewise too the eclipses of the sun, and the moon's hidden withdrawals, you must reckon can come about from several causes. For why should the moon be able to cut off the earth from the sun's light, and block the sun's high face from view for the lands, throwing its dark disk in the way of the burning rays, while at the same time, some other body should be thought unable to do the same, a body which always moves along devoid of light? And why should the sun, too, grown languid, not be able to let its fires die down at a fixed time, and renew its light, once it has passed through regions in the air hostile to its flames, which cause its fires to be quenched and to die out? And why should the earth, in turn, be able to rob the moon of its light, and hold the sun, overwhelmed, above itself, while month by month, the moon glides through the rigid shadow of the cone, while at the same time some other body could not slip beneath the moon, or glide above the sun's disk, breaking in between its rays and its outpoured light? And yet, if the moon itself shines with its own brightness, why should it not be able to grow faint in a certain region of the sky, while it passes through regions hostile to its own light? While, month by month, it glides through the rigid shadow of the cone, as for what remains? Since, throughout the blue expanses of the great world, I have shown by what means everything that happens could be explained, so that we might come to know the varied courses of the sun and the moon's movements, what force and what cause sets them going, and in what way their light blocked out, they might be eclipsed and cover the unsuspecting lands with darkness, when they, as it were, close their eyes shut. And then, their light open again, look out upon all things, flooding every place bright with clear light. Now I return to the newness of the world, and to the soft young fields of the earth, what, in its fresh fruitfulness, it first raised up into the shores of light, and entrusted to the uncertain winds. To begin with, the earth gave forth the race of grasses, and their green brightness, around the hills and across all the plains, the flowering meadows gleamed with a greening color. And to the various trees was then given, up through the air, a great contest of growth, with the reins let loose. Just as feathers and hair and bristles are first produced on the limbs of four-footed creatures and on the bodies of winged flyers, so then the new earth first raised up grasses and shrubs, and thereafter created the generations of mortal beings, many of them, in many ways, arising by varied means. For living creatures cannot have fallen down out of the sky, nor can land creatures have come forth out of the salt lagoons. It follows, then, that the earth has rightly won the name of mother, since all things have been created out of the earth. And even now many living creatures still arise out of the earth, formed by rains and by the warm heat of the sun. So it is the less to be wondered at, if more creatures arose then, and larger ones, grown to maturity when earth and sky were new. First the race of winged things and the various birds hatched, leaving their eggs in the season of spring, as now in summer the cicadas leave their smooth husks of their own accord, seeking sustenance and life. Then it was that the earth first gave forth mortal generations, for much heat and moisture then abounded in the fields. Wherever a suitable region of the place offered itself, there grew up wombs, clinging to the earth by roots. And when the ripe age of the infants had opened these, fleeing moisture and seeking after the air, nature there would turn the openings of the earth and force it to pour out through opened veins a fluid like milk, just as now every woman, when she has given birth, is filled with sweet milk, because all that rush of nourishment is turned toward her breasts. The earth gave food to the children, the warmth clothing, the grass a bed it offered, abundant with much soft down. But the world's youth stirred up neither harsh frosts, nor excessive heats, nor winds of great force, for all things grow together equally and take on their strength. Therefore, again and again, having gained the name of mother, the earth holds it deservedly, since she herself created the human race and poured forth, at nearly one fixed time, every animal that ranges wildly through the great mountains, and at the same time the birds of the air in their varied forms. But since she must have some limit to her bearing, she ceased, as a woman wearied by long age. For time changes the nature of the whole world, and one condition must take over all things from another, nor does anything remain like itself. All things migrate, nature changes all things and compels them to turn. For one thing rots away and grows feeble with age, while another grows up and comes forth from contempt. So thus time changes the nature of the whole world, and one state takes the earth over from another, what it could do before it cannot, what it could not do before it now can. And then the earth also strove to create many monstrous things, risen up with strange face and limbs, the androgyne between the two and neither, removed from both, some deprived of feet, others in turn bereft of hands, some found mute without a mouth, others blind without a face, and some bound fast in every limb, clinging through the whole body, unable to do anything or to move anywhere, unable to avoid harm or take what use required. Other monsters and prodigies of this kind she created, in vain, since nature forbade their growth, and they could not reach the desired flower of youth, nor find food, nor be joined in the works of Venus. For we see that many things must come together in order that creatures may forge onward by propagation. First that there be nourishment, then that seeds be able to flow through the limbs when the body's members are relaxed, and that the female be able to be joined to the male, that each have the means by which they exchange mutual joys between them. And many generations of living things must then have perished and been unable to forge offspring by propagation. For whatever creatures you see feeding on the vital airs, either cunning or courage or else swiftness has kept that race safe from the beginning of its age. And there are many that, by their usefulness to us, remain commended, handed over to our protection. First, the fierce race of lions and their savage generation's courage has guarded, foxes their cunning, and stags their flight. But the light-sleeping hearts of dogs with their faithful breast, and every race born of beast of burden stock, and the wool-bearing flocks together, and the horn generations, all these, Memmius, have been handed over to the protection of men. For eagerly they fled wild beasts and followed peace and won abundant food without labor of their own, which we give them as rewards for the sake of their usefulness. But those to whom nature gave none of these things, nor could by their own accord live, nor give to us any usefulness, for which we might suffer their kind to be fed and kept safe under our protection, these of course lay as prey and gain for others, all of them entangled in their own fatal chains, until nature reduced that race to destruction. But centaurs never existed, nor at any time can there be such a thing, of double nature and twofold body, compacted from limbs of different origin, with the power of each part from this side and that, sufficient to match the other. One can grasp this, however dull-witted, from what follows. First, when 3 years have gone briskly round, the horse flowers in its prime, but not at all the boy, for often even now he will seek in his sleep the milk-giving breast. Later, when the horse's strong powers fail in decrepit age, and its limbs grow feeble as life ebbs away, only then does youth, flowering in the boy's years, come upon him and clothe his cheeks with soft down. Lest by chance you believe that centaurs could be made from man and the beast of burden stock of horses, nor that they exist, or scyllas, halfsea in body, girt about with savage dogs, and other such things of this kind, whose limbs we see at discord with one another. For they neither flower together nor take on their strength in their bodies at the same time, nor shed it in decrepit age, nor burn with a like passion, nor agree in their ways, nor are the same things pleasing throughout their limbs. Indeed, one may see bearded goats often grow fat on hemlock, which for man is a sharp poison. And since flame commonly sears and consumes the tawny bodies of lions, just as it burns every kind of flesh and blood that exists anywhere on earth, how could it be that, with a threefold body in one, a lion in front, a serpent behind itself in the middle, the chimera could breathe fierce flame outward from its mouth? So too whoever imagines that such creatures could be born. When the earth was new and the sky fresh, relying on this one empty word, newness, alone, may by the same reasoning babble much else from his mouth. He may say that then golden rivers commonly flowed over the lands, and that trees regularly bloomed with jewels. Or that man was born with such vast reach of limb that he could set his feet stride across the deep seas and turn the whole sky about him with his hands. For though there were many seeds of things in the earth at the time, when the earth first poured forth living creatures, that is still no sign that mixed creatures could have been created among themselves, with the compacted limbs of living things, because the kinds of grasses and grain crops and thriving orchards, which even now abound from the earth, still cannot be created intertwined with one another. But each thing proceeds by its own way, and all keep their distinctions by a fixed compact of nature. And that human race in the fields was then far harder, as befitted what the hard earth had created, and built within on larger and more solid bones, fastened through its flesh with strong sinews, not easily seized by heat or by cold or by strange food or any failing of the body. And through many cycles of the suns revolving round the sky, they dragged out life after the wandering manner of wild beasts. Nor was there any sturdy guider of the curved plow, nor did anyone know how to work the fields with iron, nor to plant new shoots in the earth, nor to lop old branches from tall trees with pruning hooks. What the sun and rains had given, what the earth had created of its own accord, that gift satisfied their hearts enough. Among the acorn-bearing oaks they mostly nourished their bodies, and what you now see in winter time ripening to a deep red color, the arbutus, the earth then bore in far greater abundance still. And besides much else, the flowering youth of the world then bore as coarse food, ample for wretched mortals. But rivers and springs called them to slake their thirst, just as now the rush of water down from great mountains calls far and wide to the thirsting generations of beasts. Finally, as they wandered, they held the known woodland shrines of the nymphs, from which they knew that gliding streams washed the wet rocks with abundant flow, wet rocks, dripping above with green moss, and in part bubbled and burst forth over the level plain. Nor yet did they know how to handle fire or to use skins and to clothe their bodies with the spoils of beasts, but dwelt in groves and hollow mountains and forests, and hid their filthy limbs among the bushes when driven to avoid the lashings of the winds and rains. Nor could they look to the common good, nor by any customs among themselves did they know how to live, nor by any laws. Whatever prize fortune had offered to each, he carried off, each one taught by his own accord to thrive and live for himself. And Venus joined the bodies of lovers in the woods, for either mutual desire brought each woman together, or the man's violent force and unchecked lust, or a price, acorns and arbutus berries or choice pears. And trusting in the marvelous strength of their hands and feet, they hunted down the woodland generations of wild beasts with thrown stones and the club of great weight. Many they overcame, a few they avoided by hiding. And like bristly swine, they gave their woodland limbs naked to the earth by night when overtaken, wrapping themselves round about with leaves and branches. Nor did they, in great lament, seek the day and the sun through the fields in fear, wandering in the shadows of night, but silent they awaited, buried in sleep, until the sun should bring its rosy torchlight to the sky. For since from childhood they had always been used to seeing darkness and light born in alternating turn, it could never be that they should wonder at this nor distrust that eternal night might hold the lands forever, the sun's light forever withdrawn. But this was rather their concern, that the generations of wild beasts often made rest unsafe for the wretched. And driven from their home, they fled their rocky shelters at the coming of the foam-mouthed boar and the mighty lion, and in the dead of night, trembling, they yielded up, to their savage guests, beds strewn with leaves. Nor then, much more than now, did mortal generations leave the sweet light of life with lamentation. For then more often it was that some one of them seized, provided living food for beasts, devoured by their teeth, and filled the groves and mountains and forests with his groaning as he saw his living flesh entombed in a living tomb. But those whom flight had saved with body gnawed, afterward, holding their trembling palms over their foul wounds, called upon Orcus with horrifying cries, until savage writhing pains deprived them of life, helpless, ignorant of what their wounds required. But not many thousands of men, led beneath their standards, did a single day give over to destruction, nor the storm-tossed waters of the sea dash ships and men against the rocks. For often the sea, having risen up in vain and to no purpose, raged and lightly laid aside its empty threats, nor could the smiling deceit of the calm sea, treacherous, entice anyone into ruin with its laughing waves. The wicked art of shipbuilding then lay unknown. Then again a want of food gave over their failing limbs to death, while now instead abundance of things overwhelms them. They then, unwary, would often pour poison upon themselves. Now, more skillfully, they give it to others. Thereafter, when they had gotten huts and skins and fire, and woman joined to man withdrew into one dwelling, these things became known, and they saw offspring created from themselves, then the human race first began to soften. For fire brought it about that their chilled bodies could no longer so easily bear the cold beneath the sky's covering, and Venus lessened their strength, and children by their endearments easily broke down the proud spirit of their parents. Then two neighbors began, desiring it, to join friendship among themselves, neither to harm nor be harmed, and they commended to protection children and the race of women, when with voice and gesture, stammering, they signified that it was right that all should have pity on the weak. And yet concord could not be brought about in every way, but a good and great part kept their compacts faithfully. Or else the human race would even then have been wholly destroyed, nor could its offspring have carried on the generations until now. But nature drove them to send forth the varied sounds of the tongue, and usefulness pressed out the names of things, in no very different way from that in which infancy itself, lacking speech, is seen to draw children on to gesture, when it makes them point with a finger at what is present. For each creature feels the power it has, to what use it may put it. Before horns are grown upon a calf's brow, in anger it butts with them and presses on in hostility. But the cubs of panthers and the whelps of lions fight already with claws and feet and biting, even when teeth and claws are scarcely yet formed. The whole race of birds, moreover, we see trust in their wings and seek trembling aid from their feathers. Therefore, to suppose that someone back then distributed names to things, and that from him men learned the first words, is foolish. For why should this one man be able to mark all things with words and utter the tongue's various sounds, while at the same time others should be thought unable to do this? Besides, if others too had not likewise used words among themselves, where did the inborn knowledge of usefulness come from, planted, and where did this man first get the power to know what he wished to do and see it in his mind? Likewise, one man alone could not compel and subdue the many, conquering them, so that they should wish to learn the names of things. Nor is it easy to teach in any way and persuade the deaf what needs to be done, for they would not endure it, nor in any way would they let their ears bear any longer the unheard sounds of a voice battering them in vain. Finally, what is so very marvelous in this matter? If the human race, whose voice and tongue were vigorous, should mark different things by different sounds according to varied feeling. Since dumb cattle, since even the generations of wild beasts regularly raise different and varied cries when there is fear or pain, and again when joys well up. Indeed, one may learn this from things plainly evident. When the great mouths of Molossian hounds, provoked, their soft jaws first snarl, baring their hard teeth, their bristling rage threatens in a far different sound than when they are already barking and filling everything with their voices. But when they try tenderly to lick their pups with their tongue, or when they dandle them, powerful though they are in paw and bite, mimic gentle bites with poised teeth, they fawn in a whimper of voice, far different in kind, and again when left alone they whine within the house, or when they flee with body cowering from blows, whimpering. Again, does not the neighing likewise seem to differ? When among mares a young stallion in the flower of his age rages, struck by the winged spurs of love, and gives forth a snorting from flared nostrils for the charge, and when otherwise he neighs with limbs shaken in some other way. Finally, the race of winged things and various birds, hawks and ospreys and gulls, seeking sustenance and life amid the salt waves of the sea, utter far different cries at different times, both when they contend over food and struggle over prey. And some change their harsh-sounding songs along with the weather, as the ancient generations of crows and flocks of ravens, when they are said to call for water and rain, and sometimes to summon winds and gales. Therefore, if varied feelings compel animals, mute though they are, to send forth varied cries, how much more fitting was it that mortal men should then have been able to mark one thing and another different things by different sounds? Lest by chance you silently ask this in these matters, it was lightning that first brought fire down to earth for mortals. From it all the heat of flames is spread abroad. For we see many things set ablaze, kindled by heavenly fires, when the sky's stroke has bestowed its heat. And yet, too, when a branching tree, buffeted by winds and swaying, sways and leans, pressing against the branches of another tree, fire is squeezed out, rubbed forth by mighty force, and at times the fervid heat of flame flashes out, while branches and trunks rub against one another. Either of these could have given fire to mortals. Then the sun taught them to cook food and soften it with the heat of flame, since they saw many things grown mellow, subdued through the fields by the beating of its rays and its heat. And day by day more and more, those who excelled in talent and were vigorous in mind showed others how to change their former food and life for new things and for fire. Kings began to found cities and to place a citadel, a stronghold and refuge for themselves, and they divided cattle and lands and gave them out according to each man's looks and strength and talent, for looks counted for much, and strength was vigorous then. Later property was invented, and gold discovered, which easily stripped honor from the strong and the handsome. For most men, however strong and however handsome by birth, follow the party of whoever is richer. But if a man should govern his life by true reason, great riches for a man are to live sparingly with a calm mind, for there is never a lack of a little. But men wish to become famous and powerful, so that their fortune might rest on a stable foundation, and being wealthy, they might be able to lead a peaceful life. In vain, since in struggling to rise to the summit of honor they made the path of the way dangerous. And yet even from the summit, envy, like a lightning bolt, sometimes casts down those struck, scornfully, into foul Tartarus. Since envy, like lightning, most often sets ablaze the summits, and whatever is raised higher than the rest. So that it is far better to obey in peace than to wish to rule affairs with power and hold kingdoms. Therefore let them sweat, wearied, to no purpose, and bleed struggling along ambition's narrow path, since they get their wisdom from another's mouth and seek things from what they have heard rather than from their own senses, nor is it any more so now, nor will it be soon, than it was before. Therefore, once kings were slain, the ancient majesty of thrones and proud scepters lay overthrown, and the illustrious blood-stained emblem of the highest head mourned its great honor beneath the feet of the crowd. For what was too greatly feared before is trampled eagerly underfoot. So the matter returned to the lowest dregs and to turmoil, as each man sought command and supremacy for himself. Then some taught how to create magistrates and established laws so that they might be willing to use statutes. For the human race, worn out with living by violence, lay weakened by feuds, the more readily did it of its own accord submit to laws and strict statutes. For since each man prepared to avenge himself more fiercely out of anger than is now permitted under fair laws, for this reason men grew weary of living by violence. From this, fear of punishment taints the prizes of life.